Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the show, Utah's Hispanic population sees more coronavirus cases than any other race or ethnicity in the state. Environmentalists say the long-awaited strategic plan for the Utah Inland Port uses a lot of green jargon but is low on sustainability specifics. And super-spreading events, the scenarios that you want to avoid to try to stay safe. On the phone for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Good morning, and thanks for joining, Taylor.
Good morning.
And Tribune reporter Alex Vahar. Good morning, and welcome to you, Alex.
Good morning.
And a little bit later in the show, we will hear from reporter Andy Larson as well. Stay tuned for that. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments as well. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also always tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We're going to begin with Alex Vahar and this surprising and maybe, well, troubling report about some data on coronavirus. And Alex, the data paints a picture showing that Hispanic Utahns account for a big chunk of the state's case count. Alex, to what extent is that the case? Or maybe tell us what the data actually shows.
So the data shows that although the Hispanic population in Utah accounts for only 14.2% of the entire population of the state, all races. They account for almost 39% of the case counts. They're at 3,461 positive cases right now. The data that the state has is recent as of yesterday.
Right.
And the highest, the second highest, is that of white people, which is 3,414, and that is, it's interesting that you say it's surprising, because the people that myself and Norma Gonzalez, the other reporter who's kind of working on this project with me, they have said that it's actually not all that surprising. Hispanic workers, Hispanic people, and generally all other communities of color, they have jobs that are essential. You know, they're right. People who work restaurants, they're custodians, they're migrant workers, all these other kinds of jobs. And a lot of times they have two or three jobs just to make ends meet. They don't have the luxury of working from home like you or I may have.
Right.
And
go ahead. Oh no, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. That's something that, as far as that why goes, like why the Hispanic population in Utah has this disproportionate, positive case count. You spoke to former state representative Rebecca Chavez Hauk, who pointed to exactly the things that you're talking about, the fact that that they are on these frontline jobs basically, and aren't able to ride this out essentially.
Yes, exactly. And Rebecca and other community leaders and state officials have said that while the data sort of points to the why, there really isn't enough data to kind of say conclusively that it's because of their jobs or their incomes or other kind of anecdotal evidence that you hear all the time about these types of communities. We've had officials and epidemiologists say that what we really need to understand that data more is more data.
Alex, there's this other metric as well, the rate of positive cases for every 100,000 people in a given community. Can you just break that down for us when it comes to, the coronavirus case count for various Utahns or various groups of Utahns?
Well, myself and Norma have really been kind of focusing more on the raw data more than the case for 100,000. So unfortunately, I can't really speak to that.
Okay. And that's fine. Let's see, in terms of the what's happening here in Utah, this also mirrors national trends as well, meaning people of color are hit harder by this virus, not just here in Utah, but obviously around the country as well. I know that that's something that you reported on. In terms of the disparity between whites and Hispanics, the data shows that is something that is present and actual. And you also reached out to the group Comunidades Unidas, which is a Latino advocacy group here in Utah. You spoke to a representative of the group, Maria Montes. What did she have to say about that disparity?
Well, Maria, and as well as a bunch of other people that we've spoken to, have all pointed to the possibilities of why the data is showing what it shows. And she just echoed other people saying that what we're seeing is it's the frontline workers. It's these populations that are just, they're not able to be at home. They're not able to socially distance because of how they live. You know, a lot of times you see in smaller apartments or houses, there's a lot of people, multi-generational families, things like that.
Right.
So even if somebody is feeling sick or maybe even has COVID-19, they can't really be away from their families like other people can. And, it just makes it easier for it to spread among their household. Another thing that she said is the response in the Hispanic community has been kind of a little bit late. When the pandemic hit, I think a lot of the policies that were sort of coming up and some of the protocols were geared more toward people who are able to socially distance better and are able to work from home. And kind of later when they realized, hey, this is really hitting these communities really hard, we have to figure out how to help them, how to get them the right information, how to get them information in their language, and they're kind of playing catch up right now.
Talking about playing catch up, do you know if the state is trying to find ways to, you know, address this disparity? I think that's kind of hard when you have, you know, people who are, when the disparity might have something to do with, you know, who has which jobs, it might be more ingrained than simply doing outreach. But what is the state doing to try and address this disparity?
Yeah, so that's actually going to be coming in a larger story that myself and Norma have been working on the past couple of weeks. But some of the things that they're doing or have already done involve translating documents and information and disseminating it to the community through the coronavirus website the coronavirus area of the state's website. They're trying to hire contact tracers who speak Spanish. They're trying to, they've held all these types of sort of like virtual events that are geared toward giving the Hispanic community and other communities of color just information. It's kind of like a big unofficial education campaign that the state is doing, just to try and kind of tell them, you know, this is where you can get tested. This is what is required of you when you get tested. This is what is not required. A lot of what we're hearing and what they're hearing as well is a lot of people are kind of afraid to give their information because they don't know where it's going to go. And in the undocumented community, they're kind of afraid that their information, if they get tested and they give it out, that it could go to immigration authorities. And there's had the state officials and health officials have had to say that's not true. And, you know, and sometimes there could be misinformation out there, or like one person told me, they're so busy working that there's really not a lot of time to kind of just digest all this information that seems to be changing constantly. So it's really been a big education effort right now.
Alex, before we move on, which we do need to do shortly, what are we missing from this story that you and your colleague, Norma Gonzalez, reported on? What's a piece of this pie that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I think what's interesting is the efforts that have been done already in the past few weeks. Officials are happy with that, but they do say that they need more data, and I think that's important. I think that's important to note that that the Hispanic community sometimes they're very kind of shy, and they don't really like talking about like things like this, things that are happening to them, and especially with something like COVID that's affecting all these types of people, and it's really sometimes sowing seeds of, you know, well, if you have it, you've been irresponsible, or these kinds of feelings that kind of don't allow an already shy community to kind of come out and say, like, hey, this is my story, this is what's happening to me, this is how it's affecting me. So what Norma and I have really been attempting to do is try to tell that story, and it's kind of give the community at large a real understanding of what these types of communities have to deal with, and try to point to some of the why. And I think that it's important that as we do more reporting, that people understand that these communities are harder hit, not just with COVID-19, but with health in general.
And we will look for your future reporting on this as well. Alex Vejar is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune who has been covering the disparity in case counts in the Utah Hispanic community. And Alex, thanks for taking the time to tell us about it. And we will, again, as I said, look for your future reporting on this topic. We are also going to circle back to coronavirus later in the show. But for now, we will turn to some other news. And first, we'll remind listeners that this is Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCBW. You can join us by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to @KCPW. To Taylor Stevens now. And Taylor, you have been following the Utah Inland Port since its inception and through various protests. This week, the Inland Port Board held its first public meeting in 7 months. Before we get into what happened there, why has it been so long since the last public meeting of the Utah Inland Port Board?
That's a good question. And, you know, we can only rely on what the officials are telling us. They say that coronavirus delayed some planned meetings, but they also said that they didn't want to have another meeting until they had a strategic business plan, which has been in the works for a while. They wanted to unveil that and not give the board another meeting until they said they had more to discuss. The board used to meet monthly in its earlier years, or earlier months, I guess. But those monthly meetings stopped after protests started and were disrupting all of their meetings. So it's been 7 months since we have had any indication of what the port board has been working on.
Okay. And so there was, however, this week a public meeting, a virtual public meeting, that is. And that strategic business plan that you just mentioned for the 16,000-acre project was brought forward. What is the strategic plan, Taylor?
So the strategic plan is meant to provide a framework for how this area is going to develop. It's really a big picture plan. It doesn't have many specifics as far as policy goes. What it does is lay out the port board's values, strategic vision, and what that strategic vision is really comes back to sustainability. And that's twofold, I think. On the one hand, the board wants to address concerns from the community, which have largely centered around the project's impacts on the environment. On the other hand, they say that differentiating the port as this clean global logistics center is a really good business opportunity for the state, that they can sort of appeal to this new wave of companies that are green thinking and wanting to make sustainability a big part of their business model. So it's kind of two parts to it.
A complaint from members of the public who testified during this meeting through this virtual process, their complaint is that the plan is low on specifics, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the plan talks a lot about, you know, incentivizing certain green projects or promoting, you know, electric vehicle use, for example, but it doesn't really give many specifics on how the board is actually going to do that. And, you know, the executive director of the port board, Jack Hedge, he says that the strategic plan wasn't really designed to address all of those details. He says it's supposed to serve as a strategy document and that more specific policies will need to be adopted in the coming months, that they're still getting this off the ground, and that those more specific plans will come.
Meanwhile, the same concerns that that environmentalists have had since the beginning, things like mosquito abatement near a world-renowned habitat for millions of migratory birds, and you know, air pollution and so on, those are still there. I guess, what do officials say about the next steps in the process in terms of coming to some sort of agreement, if there is going to be agreement? I know that there are those who don't want to see the port happen at all.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important to note that the Port Authority Strategic Business Plan, it hasn't actually passed yet. The board hasn't approved it. So at this meeting, they were unveiling it, received a presentation on its sort of finer points, and they're supposed to actually adopt this at their next meeting, which is next month, June 22nd, I believe.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the next step for now. That's sort of the next step that we know of. However, the board says it's going to continue doing public engagement. They say that the strategic plan is not an end point, but sort of a beginning framework for how this is going to go. And, you know, it's interesting to see how much, you know, there's interest, there remains in this project, because with the coronavirus, I don't know, you know, how many people they were expecting to really participate in an online forum. But there was an hour and a half of public comment, not all of it negative. There were some county commissioners who spoke in favor of the proposal and of the business plan. But, you know, this is the first meeting that we've seen the port have in a long time where they've actually got through from beginning to the end without being disrupted.
Well,
and that's, I think, largely because it was online and there wasn't really an opportunity for people to come and protest.
I was going to say, Taylor, you mentioned the sort of positive comments. There's a Carbon County commissioner who basically wants in on the action of this Utah Inland Port because of basically the death of the coal industry in that county. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so just to go back a little bit, there's a proposal in the works of first satellite ports. These would be kind of offshoots of the main inland port, which is located kind of in the northwest side of Salt Lake City, also has some land from West Valley and Magna. But basically, these satellite ports, they say, would create jobs in rural Utah, would divert traffic and air quality impacts away from the Wasatch Front. So these rural county commissioners across the state are very interested in this idea. Carbon County Commissioner Tony Martinez, as you mentioned, said that, you know, for the first time in 135 years, there's not an ounce of coal being mined in Carbon County. So the county really needs to transform itself, reinvent itself, and that this satellite port, inland port concept could be the way to do that.
There's more news to get to, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, Taylor, but where are we in the port process right now? Meaning, are things being built out there by the Great Salt Lake that are now part of the port project? Is that happening already?
Yes, and this gets a little complicated because Salt Lake City actually has some grandfathered land that they retain some land use authority over because they had some agreements in place before the legislature took over the land in this area through legislation in 2018. And so that area, you know, there was a lot of protest about the final process of that among the Salt Lake City Council, and that construction is currently underway. And so this project is going, you know, there's already land also in the areas, in some of these areas of the inland port, so far from a homogeneous area or location, and this project is already underway.
Is there anything we're leaving out of this? I mean, there's a lot we're leaving out of this story, I'm sure, Taylor, and I want to squeeze in another of your stories from this past week after a break. Maybe the public comment, you said that that's open for people to comment. How does the public comment?
So there's a few ways, and all of them are listed at the bottom of our story. There's an email they can fill out, an online form at the Inland Port Authority's website, as well as a phone number that they can call. I think the last thing I'll mention is with this Zoom meeting, a lot of people had trouble getting in. So while there was robust public comments, there were also, you know, at least a dozen people who said that they weren't able to get the link to get into this meeting, and they're concerned about, you know, public meetings in the time of coronavirus. This is something a lot of government agencies are dealing with right now, is how to ensure public comment while also trying to keep everyone safe from the coronavirus. So that's something that we'll be, you know, following and looking at more, is how people can walk that line.
Okay. Taylor Stevens with the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find her story and Alex Vejar's, we were talking about earlier, at sltrib.com. We're going to take a quick break here on Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for the UPR-produced podcast Debunked is made possible by the Utah Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health, providing substance use disorder, mental health, and suicide prevention resources throughout Utah. Information at dsamh.utah.com.
This week on This American Life, Lissa Yellowbird searches for missing people. She's great at it.
It's just hard to hold my tongue because I know there's more to it.
I understand that.
Then, her own niece goes missing.
You're making me feel like I gotta say something.
You know what, Suna?
Huh?
Nobody cares about how you feel.
This week.
Saturday mornings at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens and Alex Vejar. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Taylor Stevens, we have a longer recorded feature that we will be turning to in just a few minutes, but I wanted to get to this story that you also reported on this week. There's a party switching movement afoot here in the state of Utah, people leaving the Democratic Party to go to the Republican side. Among them, former state Democratic senator and one-time Utah Democratic Party chair, Jim DeBacchus. So why is Jim DeBacchus becoming a Republican, Taylor?
Well, it's not because he believes in the party's views. It's because he wants to have a voice, he says, in the open gubernatorial race, the seat for governor, which hasn't been open in Utah since 1992. And so it's generating a lot of interest. There's four Republicans in the primary. The Democrat is going straight to the general election, so doesn't have a primary to go to. And so a lot of people are realizing that if they want to have a voice in whoever is going to likely be the next governor, because the Republican is likely to win, just looking at history and data in Utah, that they need to become a member of the Republican Party, which has closed primaries, meaning that only Republicans can vote for the Republican in the primary. So they need to switch basically party affiliation temporarily so that they can have a voice in that election.
Can you describe, so the party rules are that if you want to vote in the Republican primary, you have to register as a Republican. That's not the case for the Democratic Party?
No. So Republicans have a closed primary system. So exactly what you said, you have to be registered with the party. Democrats, you know, you can request a Democratic ballot if you're a Republican, I suppose. If you're unaffiliated, whatever party you're a member of, they have an open primary. So it's a little bit of a different system. But, you know, this is something people talk about every election, every major election. You know, there's a handful of really passionate, you know, politicos who changed their party affiliation. But what was interesting is I asked on Twitter who was thinking about doing this, and the response was pretty overwhelming. I think at one point I had 35, 40 people in my direct messages on Twitter, and a lot of people saying, you know, I've never done this before, or I never thought I would do something like this. But, you know, I feel it's really important to make sure that my voice is heard in this election.
And they want to, I mean, basically, do they have a, you know, you talked about these people who are choosing to do this, and maybe they want a more centrist, or even by some standards, a more liberal Republican nominee for governor. So who are they polling for, these party switchers?
Some of them are just trying to block former House Speaker Greg Hughes. Others said that they liked former Utah Governor John Huntsman. Others, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. Those two candidates, I think, for many people are seen as being a little bit more moderate in this race. Some of them haven't made their minds up yet. They just want to you know, have the option to vote and decide as the election gets closer. The election's June 30th, by the way. But, you know, the Republican Party isn't happy about this. I spoke with the chairman, and he says that he feels this is shows a lack of integrity on behalf of those who do it, that people who, you know, don't feel represented, that they should do the work of trying to strengthen their own party and find good candidates in their own parties rather than switching sides.
I guess there aren't any Republicans switching to, you know, to the Democratic Party for the, well, for the same reason, because Democrats have open elections, and you, if you were a Republican, you could conceivably request, could you request both ballots? Could you request the, you know, if you're a Republican, request the Democrat and the Republican primary ballot?
I believe you can only request one ballot.
Okay. I know there's a lot. There's so many other parts of the story that we could get to. I'm curious about, you know, why once you switch to the Republican Party, you would switch back to the Democratic Party if you get to vote in that, if you get to vote in that election anyway. I don't know. Parties are political animals. What does the Democratic Party say about people leaving their ranks?
You know, I did not hear back from the Democratic Party chairman. I did hear from some Democrats, though, who say they'll never make the switch, that they just don't feel right about it, that they, you know, true blue Democrats, they're going to stay with their own party. You asked earlier, you know, why would people switch back? And a lot of people I talk to, even those who identify as independents, some of the Democrats, they say that they just don't align with the party's values, that they just don't feel good about staying Republican. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, dynamic that they almost have to feel like they're identifying as something they're not to have a voice in the election. And, you know, a wide range of opinions, like I said, on whether that's the right thing to do or not.
Right. A party is a platform, but it's also for some people, it's core to their identity as well.
Yeah.
Taylor Stevens, we are going to have to leave it there. And at this moment, we're going to have to let both of our Salt Lake Tribune guests go. Well, these two Salt Lake Tribune guests go. Taylor Stevens and Alex Vahar are both reporters with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me this morning on Behind the Headlines.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks, Roger.
You're welcome. We are now going to turn to a conversation that I had yesterday with Andy Larson. Andy is normally a Tribune sports reporter, but during the pandemic, he has been digging into everything known and unknown about the coronavirus and then making that information understandable for us readers. This past week, he wrote about super spreading events and what we can learn from them and how we can stay safe as state leaders make the call to open us back up to some extent. For his article, Andy put together an alphabetical compendium of super spreading scenarios, and that's where we pick up this conversation. Take a listen. We will start in the letter B, the B's, bars and clubs. Some studies of specific events related to watering holes and dance floors, and some astounding and scary outcomes here. Can you just walk us through that? A super spreader event tied to one person's night out in South Korea.
Yeah, it's a 29-year-old man who's from a different district and then went into the nightlife district there in Seoul. And went to five different bars and clubs. They're actually gay clubs, which will the kind of the importance will come in later. And in to date, 187 positive cases have been tied to that night on the town. 93 people who were there that night, and then the remainder, the 94 other ones, are those kind of contacts of those people. It's pretty clear that at these bars and clubs, they weren't especially good about maintaining social distancing. That was one of the stipulations for opening these bars, and they really didn't stick to it. Because South Korea is so good at contact tracing, you know, they've got basically everyone's cell phone data. They know that exactly 5,517 people attended those five spots during the timeline of possible spread. But they don't know who some of these people are or how to contact them, because they didn't write down the correct names and information on the entry sheets, because homosexuality isn't necessarily always accepted there. So it's made it a little bit more tricky for them to track down who these people are and how to stop the spread in their communities.
Am I right that in total there's a cluster of 35,000 people? Is that from this one man's night out? Am I reading that right in your article?
Yeah, so 35,000 people who have been tested as a result of this cluster. And so that's the 5,000 people who were there on that night and all of their contacts, right? Whether they went to church or whether their families, their friends, whatever it is, whoever they've talked to, in the days since this one man's bar hopping spree happened.
Huh. What are the lessons here? You've got the section of your article on lessons, and they're basically, I guess for this one, nightclubs and bars, maybe not that safe.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're in an indoor place with a lot of people that like a dance club where you're within 6 feet and you're, you know, not maintaining social distancing, you're going to have a bad time. This is basically what this means. If, you know, we're seeing nearly 100 people who caught the virus from this one man's night out of town.
Okay. Well, staying in the bees, Andy Larson, buffets, for this one, they basically just don't work in the time of coronavirus, or at least not the way they used to. Tell us yeah. about this and what the lessons are.
And this one's in kind of an interesting study that was actually done by a TV station in Japan that put this fluorescent paint on people's hands and said, hey, go use this buffet. And when they turned on the black light, they're, you know, shocked to see this paint that kind of mimics the spread of the virus on everyone's hands and faces and napkins and plates and forks and whatever else, right? Because you have one person who starts sick, grabs the tongs at the buffet, picks something up, puts it on their plate, and spread happens from there just a half hour later. Now, this isn't like most of the studies in this article where we have, this was a real world situation, right? This was kind of a model, but it does show some of the problems with buffets and why Utah is currently not allowing people to serve buffets, self-serve buffets. They, you know, you need a restaurant employee there to actually put the food on people's plates. So you're kind of minimizing the spread.
And some of these businesses in Utah that do operate as buffets have permanently closed as a result, right?
Yeah, I mean, and actually the Sweet Tomatoes or Soup Plantation chain is permanently closed nationwide. Other buffets are, you know, really kind of having to reconsider what they do and how they do their business. I know the CEO of Round Table Pizza was another one who really was like, you know, I don't know if we can do this anymore.
You know, we're talking about buffets and people who might be handling equipment, salad tongs and whatnot. What about just regular restaurant settings? Is there a big difference between buffets and regular restaurants?
You know, we have a better idea of how the virus spreads in general restaurants compared to, you know, the specific category of buffets. You know, there's this story from China, the study done where a woman traveled from Wuhan with her family and sat at this restaurant on the third floor of a building and ended up transmitting the disease to 12 people, including people who were sitting at adjacent tables that ended up actually being more than 6 feet away. And they sat at these tables for a shared time of about 45 minutes. And what they found was that they thought that the droplets were traveling further than normal because of the air conditioner that was blowing the air across these tables. And so, again, it's just one of those things where you have to be kind of, restaurants, I think, should be cognizant of the circulation of their restaurant, of the air circulation. And I know that's hard to change and hard to do something about, but wherever you can introduce ventilation, I think it's an important thing. And then, you know, also be aware of kind of being at a table that is near someone else who is eating. You know, I think there is a risk of spread there if you do get one of these asymptomatic super spreaders cases that, while rare, do seem to happen in the science.
You know what, I'm looking at our time and thinking about how we're going to get through all of this. Let's maybe just do a rundown and then a lesson for each of these things. Buses, some studies on recirculating air. Tell us about that and then maybe the lessons learned.
Yeah, so in China, there was a woman who had been to Wuhan, went on a bus with 66 other passengers to a Buddhist temple, a church event. It was a 50-minute bus ride, one way. And out of those 66 people, 24 were infected. Including people who were not sitting close to that woman. And, you know, she wasn't symptomatic at the time. So it kind of shows the extent that this asymptomatic spread can have in close quarters. Now, this bus, as you pointed out, had its recirculation mode on its air conditioner. So the air kind of stayed stagnant within the bus. The study's authors have a hypothesis that maybe things would have been different if they brought in outside air. But of course, we don't really know.
Right. It's not a controlled study. It's looking at something that happened and the outcome, but not a, you know, sort of blind test. There's for the drivers, there's a particular risk.
Yeah. And there's a UK study, a United Kingdom study that basically looked at which jobs are most dangerous for their public sector employees. And they found that bus drivers or coach drivers, as they call them there, did have a much higher rate of coronavirus deaths than the rest of the population.
Wow. So the lesson here, Andy, I mean, in your article.
Lesson, I would say, you know, I think it does help to turn off the recirculation, get some outside air into your buses. And then, you know, I think being really smart about the kind of protection equipment you give to people who are in those kind of circumstances, like bus drivers, like taxi drivers in small close quarters with large groups of people.
Yeah. Well, next in the alphabetical order of this compendium of super spreader events, the C's, choirs. This is something that I think a lot of people will have heard about already, but singing in groups has shown to possibly or maybe even likely heighten your risk. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in a huge way. And even in circumstances that we'll get to later, like churches and bars where people are singing and reveling, singing seems to be a big deal. So, I mean, there's the Washington County choir practice where 61 people were present, and then 53 of those 61 contracted coronavirus after a 2.5 hour practice.
And is the thinking there that you're singing and so you're projecting the droplets of that have virus in them into the air?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's something that's been confirmed in other studies as well that are just looking at how many droplets you emit while you're doing different activities. You know, it's kind of a spectrum from quietly talking to talking loudly to shouting to then singing for a long time, and then projecting your voice naturally does release more of these large and small particles that can spread the virus.
And so the lesson is avoid choirs?
Honestly, avoid singing situations. So, I think those happen in church, those happen in a lot of different cases.
Right. Well, as you said, choirs are a component of that next item on your list, which is church. What research about church attendance and coronavirus spread has been done, and what have we learned, Andy?
Yeah, the CDC did a report in Arkansas about a pastor and his wife who began feeling sick at the beginning of March after they held a 3-day children's event at the church. And children sang, they did a buffet. So there were a couple different things that probably made this worse.
Right.
But in the end, out of this 5-day period where 92 people attended this church in rural Arkansas, 45 of them were tested due to symptoms and 35 of them tested positive. 7 of those people were hospitalized. 3 of those people died. I would also point out that the other big outbreak in South Korea was caused by the Shinjeonji Church. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce that, but in the end, that cluster actually accounted for 5,080 cases in the nation of South Korea, just from one initial super spreading event, then making its way through the community.
Wow. And that's a big portion of their overall total, right?
Yeah, at one point that was actually over half of their cases.
All right. So, I mean, in terms of lessons there, Andy, I mean, is it that you take extra precautions when you go to church? Or, here in Utah and elsewhere, churches are reopening up. The president says that they are essential businesses or essential entities, I guess. What's the lesson?
Look, I would be a little bit reluctant to go to a church right now, quite frankly, because it is a lot of people in a small closed room. You know, it's some of them have kind of the raised ceilings and more air capacity in which for the virus to flow. And you may get some, but many don't, right? And including churches here in Utah. So I think that's something to be considerate of. And then if you do go to church, I would say avoid those high spreading kind of activities, whether that's singing or buffets or handshakes or hugs or, you know, whatever it is. Like, be careful about what you do if you do go to church.
On to your next category, then, family. And in this category, you highlight just one tragic tale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's such a bummer. You know, there's this man, and this happened in February before, you know, we were really concerned about this. But man who traveled out of state, went to a close family friend's funeral in Chicago. And he had minor symptoms, kind of cold symptoms, a cough, a sneeze. But, you know, he ended up hugging some of the family of the deceased. 4 of those people who he hugged would actually contract the virus, including one of those people who died. And then 3 days later, he went to a birthday party, that same man, and 9 people attended that party. 7 people at that party got it out of the 9, and 2 further of those people died. So it just kind of shows that these few hour events where if you aren't careful about, you know, sharing food and hugging and that kind of thing, and certainly having small symptoms means you can be very contagious and even kill the people that you love, right? So that's the scary thing about this one.
And just a reminder, you don't have to be sick, as you pointed out in an earlier example. You don't have to be coughing or sneezing or even feeling slightly ill to spread this virus, right?
Yeah, certainly. And that's, we saw that in the bus example, and we'll see that in examples later on. But this man was symptomatic and so probably made the spread of it even worse.
Yeah, we're low on time, Andy. Can I have you just quickly run through grocery stores for us? It turns out that there's not as big of a risk as some people might be thinking, although you still need to be conscientious. Tell us about grocery stores.
We just haven't documented a large-scale super spreading event. And that doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. But you would think that it would have happened by now and had been figured out. So that's kind of a good sign and makes some sense, given that grocery stores tend to be big buildings with decent airflow and those kind of things.
Okay. Gyms, the answer here is that, yes, they are a potential place for coronavirus super spreading events, but kind of depends upon the same factors we've been talking about: ventilation, proximity, maybe the breathing that you are doing, the kind of activity you're engaged in.
Again, the breathing here seems to be a big one. It's these Zumba classes in South Korea. Apparently Zumba's big there. Who knew?
Yeah.
But this workshop, right, of Zumba teachers resulted in 8 Zumba teachers getting it. And then they went out to their communities and taught Zumba classes there, which resulted in even further spread. It's 112 cases actually tied to the Zumba workshop. So what's interesting, though, is that there was an instructor who taught Pilates in one room, gave it to 60% of their students. And then in that same room, a different instructor who was tested positive taught yoga, and nobody got it. So it does seem that like these kind of high activities where you've got a lot of dancing or moving or breathing or whatever it is may be more dangerous than kind of the lower intensity stretching of a Pilates or yoga. It does seem to be very correlated with how much and how strong the activity is that you're breathing out.
Sort of how forcefully you're exhaling, I guess, All right. And so I guess the lesson there is be careful how you are exercising and where you're doing it.
Yeah. I'm pretty scared of gyms right now. I'd be honest. I would much prefer to go and exercise outside at this point than be around potential spreaders of the disease inside an indoor gym.
Malls, you could almost put this category into the same as grocery stores, right? Malls are crowded. Go ahead, Andy. Sorry.
They're big buildings, and so they tend to have a lot of ventilation. We have seen a super spreader instance, but it did not get the high percentages of people infected like the choir practice or church did. So, the bigger buildings seem to do better than the smaller buildings.
Offices, office buildings. What sort of tracing has been done or research on office workers and the spreading of coronavirus has been done?
Yeah, I think this is maybe one of the most useful cases in the article. But the South Korean 19-story building, there's a call center on floor 11. And they found an outbreak of this and literally just started testing everyone who lived or worked in this building, over 1,000 people. And what they found was that 97 of them tested positive and 94 of them worked on the 11th floor in this call center. And of those 94, 89 of them worked on one side of that same call center. So like it's kind of separated with two sides with kind of an open seating arrangement with restrooms and elevators in the middle. And it was mostly everyone on this one side that got it. And those who kind of use the communal facilities like the elevators, the restrooms, et cetera, were much less likely to get it. So again, it's just another one of those things that a lot of talking in the same area over the course of time does seem to make a big difference in the spread of this thing, whereas kind of lower risk activities like using the same elevator as someone else is less dangerous.
Planes. We don't have a lot of data on COVID-19 and planes as of yet, Andy, but we do have data from other coronaviruses that have made the jump from animals to humans in the past and how they spread on planes. And they might correlate? Is that
right?
Yeah,
and in particular, the closest coronavirus we know is the original SARS-CoV-1, which caused the SARS pandemic in 2003. And there was a lot of good research done on planes with that pandemic. And, I looked at 4 planes that I could find in the research. And there was one where there was a 72-year-old infected man with a cough who did end up passing SARS to 18 passengers and 2 flight attendants, most of whom were close to him, but not all of them were. That flight was about 3 hours long. But when there were other positive cases who flew in longer flights or different flights, they weren't as effective transmitters. And this kind of gets back to maybe there being real super spreading instances of this disease where most people are not that contagious, but you get one or two people who are very contagious, and that can make a big difference. So it's kind of an interesting thing that we don't completely understand how it works, why some people are so contagious, and others, you know, it really seems to be limited to kind of the 6 feet rule.
And it could be something to do with their own physiology, who they are, and without them even knowing that they're super spreaders, we just don't know. Yeah.
And the 72-year-old man had a cough, was clearly a risk. But even given that, infected 20 people in a situation where you may not have expected it to.
But the odds, I mean, just in general, are that, the odds of a person contracting coronavirus on any given flight are actually kind of low, which I think runs against what we expect of flying and the sort of anecdotes about getting sick on planes.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like Joseph Allen, who's this professor at Harvard of exposure assessment, which is kind of figuring out which situations are dangerous and which ones aren't. I said, look, airplanes are just another kind of small place you should be worried about in the same way that you are with churches and gyms, right? Like if everyone wears masks and stays pretty silent, you're probably well off unless you have a passenger that's coughing or whatever else. But these airplanes have really good filtration systems in their circulation, in their air. Yeah. I don't know. What
air filtration.
Yeah. And it's actually the same filter that hospitals use in COVID-19 rooms while circulating the air there. So that should give people some optimism. You know, I'm not saying to go on flights all the time willy-nilly, but, you know, I don't know that flights are necessarily way more dangerous than a lot of situations that people are willing to go through right now.
You would, though, as you would in any public place, public-facing situation, you would say wear a mask when you get on.
Absolutely. And most airlines now are requiring the use of a mask for all passengers.
Okay. Moving on, and maybe just quickly over this one as well, Andy, polling places, in-person voting. If you do it quickly and spaced out, that seems to carry a relatively low risk. Is that right?
Yeah. Basically, scientists have looked at whether or not Wisconsin, who famously asked people to come to polling places, ended up spreading the virus more than it otherwise would have. And the results are mixed, but clearly it did not result in a huge growth of cases. So that gives us some idea that, hey, this might be okay if you do it well, but it's not necessarily a huge risk scenario if, you know, everyone is spread out and those kind of things are considered.
Okay, well, schools, Andy, here in Utah, a great many are slated to open up in the fall. That includes Utah State University, University of Utah. I guess maybe you're looking more at elementary schools.
I'm curious actually about universities as well. We just don't. The truth is, we don't have a lot of data because most of the places around the world, the schools were closed, right? But in the places where they have opened, or at least partially opened, there just hasn't been the kind of spread you would expect from schools. I'll say that. With influenza, for example, over 50% of cases end up traced back to children who got it from someone in a school, right? The flu, for whatever reason, schools are this huge vector of transmission. We're not seeing that with coronavirus as we track these cases. And we don't really know why kids are less effective spreaders at this disease, but they really seem to be not that effective at it. And so, you know, I would feel more confident in that and saying, hey, schools are definitely safe if we had a mechanism to explain why this was happening. But the truth is, as we look at the cases of the schools that have been open, they seem significantly more safe than you would expect.
Well, and one thing I'm sort of interested in there as well, Andy, is the spread between schools and, you know, the people who are living at home. So you've got kids at home, they go to school, they interact with other kids who may interact with people who have coronavirus, and then you come back home to your parents. Apparently, there's not a lot of spread like that happening.
There really isn't that much spread happening in that way. And again, that's very different than other diseases like the flu. So we're trying to figure out why that is. You know, I think some of it probably is the improved immune response from kids and, you know, that this is a less dangerous disease for children overall. But we're trying to figure out what factors are at play there. I should say scientists are.
Yeah, well, and you're keeping tabs on them. I guess this brings us to finally the last category in your article and actually brings us back to the beat that you normally cover, Andy, sports venues and stadiums. The Super Bowl of super spreading, is that a good analogy here?
I would say the Super Bowl of super spreading was a Champions League match in Italy where Atalanta in Bergamo, that kind of one of the famously impacted cities of this, played Spain's Valencia in a Champions League match. And 40,000 people came to Milan to watch this match. And, you know, the director of health there called it a biological bomb because you do have so much singing. You have so many people in a close space. You have people hugging and celebrating. It was a really great game for Atalanta. So they won 4-1, which is so much celebration. And then you look at even, you know, what happened in the bars there as people celebrated this huge match. Anyway, it's really clear that it doesn't make any sense to have thousands of people in one building, even if that building is outside. The more local one that might be more impactful for people here is what happened in an Indiana high school basketball tournament, where they believe five people died as a result of these high school tournament games, where a few hundred to a couple thousand people attended these games. So it's funny, like we don't have very good contact tracing of those events like we do the ones in South Korea. We can't tell you X number of people got it out of Y attendees. But it is clear that these games where one or two people had the virus and were cheering and ended up being significant community spreaders of the disease.
I guess just looking at your entire article you wrote about super spreading, is there an overall lesson here? I guess I mean with our, you know, our so-called gradual reopening, are we all now just guinea pigs in this huge experiment? And how should we all be behaving as somebody who's dug into this?
Yeah, you know, I really like what Japan did. And Japan's done a really good job of really getting control of this disease. And I think the biggest reason is that they had an effective communication strategy from the beginning to avoid what they called the three C's. And the three C's were closed spaces, crowds, and closed contact settings. So everything I looked at in that article really fits into one of those categories as to, you know, whether or not those situations are dangerous. And I think that's really what people need to think about is, am I in a crowd of people right now where I'm really interacting with a lot of people from a viral point of view? Am I in a closed space where the air isn't going to be circulating or dissipating? And then, of course, the contact, right? You know, are you within 6 feet? Are you hugging? Are you sharing food with? Are you celebrating, in the case of the sports, with some of these people? And I think just kind of avoiding those situations, those are the steps that everyday people can take while trying to avoid contracting the disease.
Andy Larson is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter who in normal times is a Utah Jazz reporter, but who here in the Upside Down is writing useful pandemic explainers. And Andy Larson, thank you once again for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
And thanks once more to Andy Larson and as well as my guests from earlier, Taylor Stevens and Alex Vejar. Find their reporting and a lot more vital journalism in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune or at sltrib.com. That does it for Behind the Headlines. Thanks to KCPW's Jesse Ellis and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay safe. Join us again next week.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in this morning. UPR Presents is up next, followed by Here and Now at 11 o'clock.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.